From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories. Your moderator is Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Issues in the News begins now.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard, and joining me on the show today are David Rennie, the Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist, and Tim Mack, Senior Congressional Correspondent for The Daily Beast. Here are the issues. Scotland voted not to secede from the United Kingdom and become an independent country, but the independence campaign has spurred similar efforts in Wales and in other European countries. In Washington, a rift over how to pursue the war against ISIS in Iraq has broken out between President Obama and military leaders at the Pentagon. Also in Washington, Ukrainian President Poroshenko addressed Congress, but his request for weapons to defend Ukraine against incursions by Russia and pro-Russian rebels was denied by President Obama. Well, amazingly, David, Americans like myself, who are not really, although all my ancestors from England, I'm not an Anglophile, followed this whole question of Scottish independence enormous. I read everything. Neil Ferguson, no matter who wrote about it, I read it, and it turned out to be a pretty decisive no from the Scottish voters. I mean, 55-45. And one, why did they do that? And then we'll get into the repercussions.
Well, I think Americans, in fact, the whole world, had a good reason to look at what was happening. This was not just a technical change. You know, if the Scots had voted to break off, not only were you breaking a 307-year-old union, but I think you'd have seen, you know, a major currency crisis around the world, because there were some serious questions there. You would have seen Britain's permanent seat in the United Nations Security Council, I think, would have been challenged, because, you know, we cling to that by our fingertips as it is. So that's a pretty big deal for America. They quite like having Britain sitting at the table next to them in the Security Council. Britain's nuclear submarines, they're all parked in Scotland. There's nowhere else in the UK to park them. And the Scottish government was going to chuck them out. So, you know, we did narrowly miss an earthquake. Why did they vote against? Well, the silent no majority was there. If you had only looked at what was in terms of stickers in windows, banners on the streets, tweets on social media, you would have thought that yes was heading for a landslide. It turns out that there was the famous silent majority of people who were just nervous about the implications of voting no. If you want to be a sort of sunny optimist, it was a gigantic turnout. It was nearly 90%, although that's not compulsory voting. That was a voluntary turnout of nearly 90%. And when the result was announced, everyone just peacefully went home. So it was a kind of bloodless decision. I think the big picture, getting away from the technicalities, is this is part of a kind of general populist politics that we're in. The whole rich world, people are very sort of upset about how the economy feels, how there are no more jobs for life, how people feel they can't get ahead, the squeezing of those kind of incomes for everyone but the super rich. You know, there's a very bitter rouse about welfare, how much can you afford? And, you know, this was another example of that. And in lots of countries, people are looking for a scapegoat for those forces like globalization. In this particular instance, the Scottish independence camp did very well with the argument that if the country feels all wrong, if you don't feel you can get ahead, if the economy feels like it's stacked against you, blame the English. The malevolent English have stacked all the odds against you. And otherwise, Scotland would be a sort of quasi-socialist paradise of public spending and welfare paid for by this bountiful oil under the North Sea, if only the malevolent English were not sort of ruining everything. And that very nearly did it. But thank goodness we pulled back from the brink.
Tim, you come from a Commonwealth country.
That's right.
Canada. What did you make of this?
Well, I thought a lot about 1995 and the referendum that Quebec had in Canada about whether to separate. And I remember being very young and being encouraged to write letters to cohorts in Quebec who are also 8 years old and encourage their parents to vote no to independence. I mean, it's a really fascinating time. And there are implications not just for Great Britain, but also for the United States. And I know a lot of members of Congress were expressing concern over the outcome of this referendum, whether trade policies that apply to Great Britain would apply to Scotland, the economic repercussions of a yes vote. Those sorts of things should and did concern policymakers here in the United States. And that's, I think, why there was so much interest in it, besides from the natural drama.
David, my view is that the government should never allow referendums for secession. it just creates trouble. It creates problems, even if they win those referendums, as the British government did in Scotland. The repercussions, it will go on forever. And well, we get into some of those. But could David Cameron, the Prime Minister, have said, no, we're not going to have a referendum in Scotland. We don't allow this. Scotland's part of the United Kingdom, and it's going to stay there.
Well, let's ask another question first. Would David Cameron have rather said no? Would he much prefer not to have had a referendum? Of course.
Yeah.
But what went wrong? Well, what went wrong is a number of years ago, under the old Labour government of Tony Blair, Scotland got a parliament. Mm-hmm. And so they now have Scottish-only elections to elect people to this Scottish parliament. And the system was designed in such a way, with this very sort of complicated voting system, that no one was supposed to be able to get one party an overall majority in that parliament. What happened was, a couple of years ago, there was an election in Scotland, and the Scottish nationalists, the ones who want to leave, they scored this unbelievable landslide win and ended up in complete control of the Scottish government, which wasn't even meant to be possible. And at that moment, you had to recognise there was a democratic mandate up there, that the Scottish people had given those people a mandate, mm-hmm. and it was very, very hard to say no. The problem was that until quite recently, it looked like the London government was successfully calling the Scottish nationalists' bluff. Because until 3-4 weeks ago, the polls were like 20 points ahead for no. And mm-hmm. then suddenly they closed up. So for a long time, it looked like we were calling their bluff mm-hmm. and it was going to be an easy no vote, and that mm-hmm. was going to put that to bed. But then the last 2-4 weeks, the polls closed way, way up. What really moved was lower income, lower education, older white voters who would normally vote for the left, for the Labour Party, suddenly saying, you know what? We're fed up with being told how dangerous this is. We're fed up with all these fiddly arguments about the size of the banking sector and the money. You know, a plague on all of them. We're just going to take the risk and go for it. And that was the big closing of the polls. The reason, as far as we can tell this morning, you know, why did the vote not go for independence was those people didn't really turn out in the same numbers. Turnout was much higher in slightly more affluent areas and the really working class areas. The turnout was only 75% yeah. as opposed to kind of 90% in the mm-hmm. affluent areas.
Tim, what's your view on just telling, and we see there's going to be a referendum in Catalonia in, mm-hmm. in Spain, a non-binding referendum about secession from Spain mm-hmm. that the Spanish government in Madrid does not condone at all. But can't you just say to these regional areas that want to secede, no, you can't secede. You're not going to have a referendum, and that's it. David says you can't.
I mean, I defer to David on this particular case especially, but I think it's a helpful thing, especially if you do come out with a no vote, to say, hey, this issue has been settled at least for the foreseeable future. You guys are not breaking away. We're remaining united. I mean, that was very helpful. You know, my experience is in the Canadian case, and although there have been pushes for independence since 1995 in Canada and Quebec, it's largely been silenced, that the independence movement hasn't become and has never recovered from being the force it was in the 90s.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's always been talk in the United States. This is a somewhat outlier to mention this. There's been talk in the United States about the western provinces in Canada joining the United States. Now, as much as I've been there and they're very much like the United States, I think it would be a mistake to have a referendum in those provinces, Alberta, Manitoba, Saskatchewan, even British Columbia. No good could come of it.
I mean, it's a very marginal view and not a very popular.
I realize that.
But here's the bigger question. How, you know, and this is a question that applies in all rich Western...
Mine was the smaller question.
No. Yours was a big question. Every rich Western democracy, because the economy is not, you know, in great shape for an awful lot of people, populism is stalking the land. Mm-hmm. You know? How do established political parties and, you know, the responsible kind of business bosses and the mainstream media, what sort of arguments do you mount against populists who you think are kind of peddling myths and snake oil? And my instinct is the one really bad solution is to tell those populists that they just can't have an argument. So, you know, in Spain, the Spanish central government has said, you know, we've checked the Spanish constitution. There's a rule against splitting apart.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, it is illegal to have a referendum. Therefore, mm-hmm. the Catalans cannot even have that debate. We're going to squelch that debate.
The Spanish Constitution say that specifically?
It talks about an indissoluble union.
Okay.
Well, so, you know, that's pretty firm.
Yeah.
But that solution, it's a bit like, you know, I used to be based in Brussels covering the European Union. They had a problem, like lots of European countries, with a sort of neo-fascist anti-immigration party. Mm-hmm. So they made it illegal. They said mm-hmm. it was xenophobic. That mm-hmm. was against Belgian law. So they made it illegal. Mm-hmm. That's the wrong way to beat those political forces. You have to argue on the doorstep. You have to win the political mm-hmm. argument. You just cannot tell very angry people that they mm-hmm. have no right to express their anger politically. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that's a very dangerous path to go down.
There's one other part of this that I wanted to ask you about, and that is what happens now in Britain. The Scottish voters were heavily appeased. Scotland, own government was given more authority, mm-hmm. And there are going to be separate Scottish votes on Scottish issues and so on anyway in Parliament. What happens to the whole question of being a member of the European Union? When the English see what's happened in Scotland, they'll say, well, we need to get out of the European Union.
What you're absolutely right is that what we've done is we've woken the gigantic sleeping beast of English nationalism. Remember that in the UK, which is about 60 million people, just under 60 million people, mm-hmm. the Scots are less than 10% of the population. So 5/6 of the population of the UK is English. And English nationalism has been this sleeping beast because the English were always kind of lazy about British English. They, you know, they muddled the two up. They didn't make much of a distinction. Mm-hmm. But in essence, Scottish voters have been bribed to stay.
Yep.
And what you're going to see now, the first morning, you're already seeing this, is an English backlash. Because English voters are now, to some extent, second-class voters. And Scottish voters are, to some extent, super voters. Because Scottish voters have completely exclusive say over a whole bunch of Scottish policies. And, in the right circumstances, Scottish MPs sitting in Westminster have veto power over a whole bunch of English policies. Mm-hmm. But English voters are second-class because they don't have any say at all over Scottish policies. And they can be outvoted when it comes to English policies. And you're seeing a gigantic mm-hmm. argument, which mm-hmm. is on the one hand very technical, but on the other hand intensely political. And swirling in that English nationalism, you're absolutely right, Fred, is the promise that, depending on who wins the next British election, another referendum, this time on European Union membership. And the link there, I would say, is just as the genius of the Scottish independence crowd was to blame effectively globalisation on the wicked English.
Yeah.
The populists down south in England have very effectively made globalisation their scapegoating the European Union mm-hmm. for globalisation. Mm-hmm. And that's a very, very kind of potent populist force that's now completely unleashed.
All the fault of Brussels.
But the point is, you know, I would argue, and it's another discussion, yeah. that, you know, that's just as much of a myth yeah. as it being the English.
Sure.
You know, everyone's
sure.
looking for a scapegoat right now.
Tim, was there a backlash in Canada against the forces in Quebec that wanted independence?
No, I mean, I think what the bitterness of the loss for, they call themselves sovereigntists, I mean, for the sovereigntists was so evident that it kind of turned off the independence movement for at least a generation. Mm-hmm. Scotland probably took it totally differently, but the sovereigntist forces in 1995 blamed immigrants mm-hmm. and for their loss in mm-hmm. in the referendum, which turned off a mainstream Quebec.
Mm-hmm.
The kind of xenophobia that came out of the bitterness of that loss really mm-hmm. shut down the independence movement for a long time.
Okay, I have one more question. I don't know that how much we know about what's going to happen in northern Spain and Catalonia and then the Basques and all these other. But David, what about Wales?
Wales and Northern Ireland, those are the other mm-hmm. two semi-autonomous
Wales in particular, Wales seems to be more on the agenda than Northern Ireland at the moment. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, here's the thing, and it's a pretty sort of brutal answer. If you are a Welsh nationalist, do you dream of independence from England?
Mm-hmm.
Sure you do. But they don't have oil, which the Scots have. Mm. You know, essentially, this is a poor post-industrial bit of the United Kingdom where its coal mines and its steel industry kind of collapsed.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
They just don't have the money mm-hmm. to leave. They are so completely dependent on funding from the central government in London that I think even, you know, all but the most militant Welsh nationalists realise they have no hope of making it on their own. It's a very small group of people. It's like 3 million people and mm-hmm. they have no money.
It's certainly a beautiful place, a little hard to get to, so they can't make it up in tourism.
It's a lovely place, mm-hmm. Pretty grim weather. But no, it's absolutely beautiful. But I mean, you know, it'd be like in the American context, West Virginia declaring independence.
Yeah. Well, West Virginia was a part of Virginia 150 years ago, but that's a different story, and I'm not going to go into it. We're going to take an early break here and remind the listeners that this is Issues in the News coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me today are Tim Mack of The Daily Beast and David Rennie of The Economist. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues Online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com. Just this past week, I'll start with you, Tim, there has broken out in public, at any rate, a really sharp disagreement between the military leaders at the Pentagon and at CENTCOM in Tampa, basically the military establishment in the U.S., over how to pursue the war against ISIS, the Islamic State, in Iraq and in Syria, between these military leaders and the president. And one, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the top military man in America, Martin Dempsey, said in congressional testimony suggested that we're going to have American ground troops in combat at some point during this war. President Obama, I believe the next day or 2 days later, said once again, as he has said before, when he went to CENTCOM headquarters in Florida, said, no ground troops. We're not going to have that. Where do things stand and where is this leading?
Well, here we have President Obama, who was elected on this promise, being much more skeptical of American military power, of withdrawing the United States from foreign wars, mm-hmm. being dragged in by circumstance now again to another engagement in the Middle East. And so his pledge to say there will be no American combat troops on the ground in Iraq is very serious and I think is very firm. But that, of course, ignores the fact that we already have special operations forces in Iraq mm-hmm. today who are mm-hmm. advising in a backup role local Iraqi forces. Mm-hmm. Now, what did Martin Dempsey, the top military officer of the United States, actually say in the hearing? I mean, it's kind of been muddled up in the intervening days. He said, if our current strategy doesn't work and I believe that we need ground troops, I will go back to the president mm-hmm. and recommend ground troops. He was not saying, I think we'll need ground troops.
No, but military leaders, military people, and intelligence community people I've talked to all think that this war can't be won without American ground troops.
I think reasonable people can disagree. But
sure.
when we say that the generals and President Obama are into this gigantic tiff about mm-hmm. whether or not we need ground forces in Iraq, I'd make 2 points. A, we already have ground forces in Iraq.
Yep.
And B, they're not technically talking about large divisions of ground troops in an invasion-style force.
Yeah.
We're talking about whether special operations forces will go into the field along with Iraqi mm-hmm. security forces. That's the kind of... Even mm-hmm. the scope of the debate is mm-hmm. very minimal. Even mm-hmm. the disagreement is very minimal.
Well, I think Tim sort of downplayed this. David, what do you think?
One of the most interesting things that happened when General Dempsey was giving his testimony mm-hmm. in the Senate, I have a colleague, another journalist, who has a deaf family member, so he knows how to lip read. And he immediately emailed me that if you look at the video, the military aide sitting behind Dempsey, when Dempsey says that precise thing about right. the ground troops, mm-hmm. one of them turns to the other and says, that's a huge deal, by the way.
Mm. Gee, well, I agree.
When you look at the video, that's what the guy definitely says.
So much for your view, Tim.
So I think, you know, let's not forget, President Barack Obama is a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
So his current statements are, to me, very lawyerish. He doesn't say there will never be American troops on the ground fighting. He says, I guarantee to you, I will not send them into a combat mission. They will not have a combat mission.
Mm-hmm.
You then saw the White House spokesman, Josh Earnest, saying to journalists, you know, let's look at the semantics of this.
Yeah.
Never a good sign when a White House spokesman uses the word semantics.
Yeah, never.
You know, hire a lawyer at that point. And he said, you know, we're talking about the possibility that the military may recommend forward deployments of troops who, of course, would not have a combat mission. You know, the mechanics of this. You know, I remember covering, you know, the only time I've ever been a war reporter was in 2001 in Afghanistan. And we were up with the Northern Alliance and the Americans were doing these airstrikes and taking out the Taliban. Mm-hmm. We didn't know exactly at the time. It turned out that we had American special forces alongside us who we couldn't see because mm-hmm. they were wearing, you know, beards and robes and stuff. Mm-hmm. But they were literally pointing their laser pointers and
yeah.
painting these targets because mm-hmm. if you want to get these precision munitions in, mm-hmm. by far the best mm-hmm. way is to have American combat guys on the ground, combat mm-hmm. air controllers mm-hmm. and forward air controllers, painting
mm-hmm.
the targets.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way to get effective airstrikes. Mm-hmm. So, and there's also the wrinkle, and Tim, having done national security, will know this better than I do. You know, you can say that there are no U.S. troops on the ground, but if you have taken special forces operatives and seconded them to the CIA,
right.
and so they're currently not military, they can be on the ground already, and there are no U.S. troops on the ground.
Yeah,
because
there
are CIA paramilitaries.
Yeah.
So these
yeah.
are all kind of legalistic. Mm-hmm. But the slippery slope point that I think yeah. you're making, Fred, I
yeah.
think has got to be right.
Mm-hmm.
That's where this is headed.
Mm-hmm. In terms of winning a war, air power is important, but it's hard to win a war that way, particularly one against ISIS, which is a terrorist army. I mean, mm-hmm. it's not like the a huge force that marches in and, mm-hmm. and fights. It's not quite that. Anyway, the prior president, who I think President Obama is most like, is Woodrow Wilson, who was a professor at Princeton and so on before he was elected governor of New Jersey and then president in 1912. And he was famous, of course, in 1916. World War I was going fiercely by then in Europe, of his slogan, or what was used to promote him, was, he kept us out of war. Well, in 1917, he got the U.S. into the war.
Well, look at FDR, who ran against the war.
Well, FDR, he ran against it, but he was in favor of it. I think Woodrow Wilson really meant it when he said that in 1916. But the factors on the ground changed dramatically, Tim.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very similar situation to what this president is now faced with, mm-hmm. which is he would very much prefer to focus on domestic issues and withdraw, you know, military forces from the region to an extent.
Mm-hmm.
But because of circumstances, because of dramatic shift in American public opinion after after the execution of two American journalists, mm-hmm. congressional pressure too, his hand has been forced.
Mm-hmm. Well, it has been forced. And David, what is, I don't know what the British view is, but one of the problems with this coalition that President Obama is setting up is countries, they want to be a part of it, but they don't want to do much. What about the British?
Well, I think also, you know, what that really betrays is that we're not quite sure what the war aim is, because my sense of American public opinion is that it has been, as Tim says, galvanized to a really remarkable extent mm-hmm. by the terrible beheading of the two American and now one British journalist, which has had far more impact on public opinion in a short space of time than 200,000 dead Syrians.
Yes.
My take on the American public is that they remain as war-weary as ever, but they want to feel safe.
Mm-hmm.
And those two desires are now clashing. Mm. And their war objective isn't really a war objective in terms of how they would like to move the chess pieces in the Middle East. What they want is to be assured that these terrorists are not going to keep cutting American heads off and can't attack the American homeland.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not really the war objective that is possible on the ground by bombing ISIS. But I'm not sure the American public has a kind of plan for what they want to see the Middle East look like. They just want to feel safe.
Yeah.
And so... Mm. You know, then you get into, you know, building this coalition. Should America worry that the Arab countries much closer to this problem seem to be less keen on action than America is?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can't want to wipe them out more than your regional partners.
True.
So I worry that we're going into this war again with the classic mistake is to go in not actually knowing what your objective is.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's one of the problems that military leaders cite and intelligence officials cite privately, not publicly. Okay. Let's turn to Ukraine. The president of Ukraine, Petro Poroshenko, spoke before Congress, and he came to the United States, Tim, partly in search again for weapons to help defend Ukraine. Now, President Obama has offered millions of dollars in various non-lethal equipment militarily, but not weapons. Why not?
Well, I mean, I think this is a continuation of our prior conversation. This is not a president that particularly wants to arm, to use military might, to use force, except when he's absolutely pushed to the brink to do so. And, you know, it's gotten a lot of congressional pushback. You have senators who are very supportive of the Ukrainian government saying, hey, you can't fight a war with blankets. You can't fight a war with meals ready to eat. That the Ukrainian people who are really fighting for the very existence of their state need our help, and we're not providing weapons to them.
But putting it another way, I mean, it's tragic to see a Ukrainian president saying, you know, arm us and America saying no. But here's the thing, that those members of Congress who find it very convenient to attack the president, how far do they want to push that?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, imagine President Obama said, OK, I'm going to keep arming the Ukrainians until they win. I mean, Russia has a pretty big military, and at the back of that military is nuclear forces. I mean, how far do you want to push this? Do you want to have a war between America and Russia over Ukraine? Of course not. Nobody wants to have a war with Russia. So ultimately, if... at some point, America would stop arming Ukraine. If Russia kept escalating and the Russian army's involvement became more and more overt and more massive, if at some point we would eventually betray the Ukrainians, where's the advantage in arming them some of the way if ultimately we don't actually plan to have a war with Russia to save Ukraine?
The one reason would be this would deter the Russians. Now, President Obama feels it would provoke the Russians. My fear is that it would... give Russian President Putin justification. He would use this as justification to do more. Look, they're sending in arms, and these poor people, these in eastern Ukraine, are going to suffer because this heavily armed now Ukrainian army. And I think you get the drift.
Yeah, the fundamental political problem here is this matters more to Vladimir Putin than it does to us.
Mm-hmm. Tim, I agree with that. It's
much further away. I mean, I think David made a really, really very important point earlier in the show when he was talking about the difference in the deaths of 200,000 Syrians versus two American journalists. Ukraine is very abstract to most Americans. We don't see Americans dying in the Ukraine.
Petro Poroshenko. Petro Poroshenko. I'm just trying to show
tycoon.
That I can't pronounce his name.
Candy tycoon.
Yeah. Are any European countries eager to, or European politicians, David, eager to arm the Ukrainian army? I haven't heard of any.
No. Mm-hmm. Although at least the French are no longer arming the Russian Navy. So, you know, let's be grateful for small blessings.
I thought they backed away from that.
Yeah, yeah, they're no longer willing to.
Yeah, well, that's good. And the French have said they're not going to do airstrikes.
French airstrikes have just happened over Iraq.
Yeah. I thought they weren't going to do them.
But no, I think we just had the first overnight.
Well, I realize that. And the French have a real air force, unlike some countries that don't have the kind of militaries that they used to.
They do. I remember a senior NATO official saying to me once, the dirty secret of NATO is there are two groups which we don't describe in public, which is countries prepared to kill foreigners and countries that aren't.
Yeah.
France is on the list of willing to kill foreigners.
I guess they are. Well, let me end with this, and I'll start with you, Tim. Will at some point the United States have to provide some level of weapons for the Ukrainian army?
No. I don't think that there is any sort of, you know, deep pressure to do so. There are geopolitical interests in Ukraine, and there's, of course, an interest for the United States to push back against Russia, especially given their aggression over the last year. But in terms of arming Ukraine, I mean, I don't see what the impetus would be.
David, same question.
I think Ukraine is going to have to, you know, essentially cede those eastern areas. I think that's where we're ending.
You mean officially or just...
No, they'll be sort of autonomous, you know, but basically Russia will get a veto over those eastern areas. And you can see the Ukrainian parliament's already, you know, heading in that direction.
Okay, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. I emphasize Lexington columnist because it's a great column. And Tim Mack, Senior Congressional Correspondent for The Daily Beast. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites. I'm Fred Barnes of The Weekly Standard. Thanks for listening.
From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.